Major Peter Cochrane, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Major Cochrane?
I was born in Glasgow on the 12th of May, 1919.
And could you tell us a little about your family background?
Well, it certainly wasn't a military background. My father was a civil engineer. He'd been born in Ayr. He became a civil engineer before World War One, and he was engineering in what used to be called the Federated Malay States, and now Malaysia, when war broke out in 1914. And he got a boat back to the UK and enlisted in one of the new army battalions of the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders, as a private soldier, of course. And as a private soldier, he went with the battalion to Loos. That was his first action. He was very lucky to come out unscathed because the battalion had enormous casualties. The only casualty, I think, was his kilt, which was torn to ribbons on barbed wire. And he was issued with a new kilt, which the tartan of which I still have and use as a sort of rug. He was then commissioned into what was his county regiment, Royal Scots Fusiliers, and with them went to the Somme, and went again unscathed through the Somme fighting. And then I suppose he was fed up with mud and trenches, because he went into the Royal Flying Corps, not as a pilot, but I think perhaps due to the fact that as a civil engineer he was very accustomed to map making and ground configuration. He was a balloon observer, and he went on in balloons to the end of the war. Ended up commanding a balloon company. And it may not have been muddy like the Somme, but it was certainly just as dangerous, because the balloons, of course, were sitting targets, both for artillery, shrapnel in particular, to puncture them, and German fighter planes. And he was shot down at least three, and I think four times, and had to use his parachute on one occasion, because incendiary bullets were used very often by German fighters to set the balloon on fire, the gas on fire. One occasion his parachute got hooked into the burning basket under the balloon, and he had to climb back up into the balloon and release the parachute and flick it out in the air, hoping it would open, and then jump. So he had a very lucky war, in a way, a very hairy one. And he never, ever talked about it, except occasional sort of comical stories about what soldiers had said in various circumstances. He never talked about his own doings at all. And I really deduced what I know about them from official now RAF documents, reports from his commanders. My mother, who had been born in Glasgow, parents lived in Glasgow, she had been on the stage before World War One with what really was a sort of forerunner of what's now the Glasgow Citizens Theatre. And she had acted and remained all her life very close friends with people like Sybil Thorndike and Lewis Casson, Theeny Silo and her husband Nicholas Hannon, and Jean Cadell, as we call her, Caddle, they call her in London. And she met my father in 1916, and they were married in 1917 when he was on leave. And I was born, as I say, in 1919. About the just about the time, no, slightly before the time he was demobilized, because I've got a photograph of him and my mother. I'm a fairly newborn infant lying in her lap, and he is wearing RAF uniform, but he'd been awarded the MC, mentioned in dispatches, but the dispatches mention still refers to him as Major, even though the RFC had become the RAF by that time. And immediately after he was demobilized, he obviously went back again to civil engineering, and his experience had been before the war in the Far East, so he went back to the Far East, but this time to China. And my mother, with me as her infant in arms, followed him some months later after he'd found a house in Shanghai, where he was primarily engaged in building the docks, harbour works, which, of course, were then all blown up when the Japanese invaded China. And my sister, in fact, was born in Shanghai.
So you were out there from late 1919 to...
It was probably 1920, second half of 1920, for about 4 years. And then...
Do you remember much about it? I mean, you were very young.
Yeah, quite a lot about China. Snatches. Mostly about the household staff. The fact that I was very soon outgrew having an armour, but my sister's armour was an enormous friend to us both. The number one boy in the house was all Chinese tend to spoil children ludicrously. I had, for instance, another small English boy, and I shared a donkey, and I think it was on alternate days we were taken by the donkey boy, of course being a misnomer for a man, a youngish man, for a ride on the donkey, and round and round the botanic gardens in Shanghai. And obviously he found this boring, and I found it boring. And so, without a word being said, he led me one day out of the European quarter down into his own, where his family lived, in a sort of seething mob of tiny little streets. And his family made me great welcome, made me a sort of honorary member of the family. And I had delicious and totally forbidden, I'm sure, things to eat. And he never said a word to me about this being secret, but I obscurely realized this was something between him and me. And we weren't found out, or he wasn't found out, for I don't know how long, months it seems to me. Then, of course, the poor chap was dismissed, and I was given huge doses of castor oil, long after the castor oil would have been of any use. And another occasion I remember, I was taken to the Shanghai races, which I suppose was probably twice a year. And I took the opportunity of scampering away from my parents, and again fetched up with where all the activity was, which was with the Chinese people attending the races. And eventually I was found, and nobody knew who I was, found by some Europeans wandering around and taken back. And I was actually, so I was told later by my parents, I was made to stand up on the bar in the huge tent which was serving drinks, in the pretty sure knowledge that somebody would come in, see me standing on the bar, would know who I was, and I was duly reclaimed. And the same thing when we were not in Shanghai, but the places, like up in the hills, a place called Mokenshan, which was the road to which was so steep that you had to be carried up in a litter. And I still vividly see in my mind's eye the being carried up in a litter with very slippery looking cobbles up a whole series of steps up a mountainside, with coolies carrying flaming torches either side to light the path for the litter bearers. And again, they were easy and kind, easy to get on with and kind. Or there's a port called Wei Hai Wei, where we used to go in the summers to get away from the frightful sticky heat of Shanghai. And there again, I seemed to make a habit of this. I sort of ran off to the local village, and again, I was immediately befriended by the first Chinese family I came across, and again, ate all sorts of, to me, delicious sweetmeats and things, which were looked on as possibly anathema by my parents. Again, more castor oil, which I can still see floating on the surface of a glass of orange juice. So my memories of China are sort of series of snapshots, but they're all, as far as the Chinese people I came across, they're very happy snapshots. They were very, very good.
Now, how about when you came back to England? I mean, that must have been a bit of a shock. You wouldn't really have known anything else.
Not at all. No, it's my first view. We were in London for a bit.
That would be about late 23, or would it be?
Yes, that would be about, 25 or 6 probably, by the time we got. Well, 24 or 5, yes. Well, my father came back from engineering in China, and for a bit he was working in this country. Then he, some years later, this must have been about 29 or 30, he was engaged by the Belgian government to take charge of the building of a new harbour at the mouth of the Congo River, a place called Matadi. And this was not a place he could take. I mean, white women weren't forbidden. So again, my mother stayed behind with us. I think we then moved to Glasgow to be nearer her sisters and her mother.
And where were you educated in? You'd be going to school?
My first recollection is of going to a school in Glasgow, Kelvin Side Academy, in the sort of very junior part of it. Then my father, after the Congo wasn't much fun. I mean, he got blackwater fever. He was lucky not to get yellow fever because it was rampant. He then began doing the same sort of job, again, harbours in docks and that sort of thing, in Java, in Surabaya. And that was working actually for a shipping company who wanted their docks to be improved or rebuilt. And I was still at an age when it was looked on as okay for children to be in the tropics. So my mother and my sister and I went out to Surabaya.
When would that be?
That must have been about 31, I should think. Something. I'm very bad on years, actually.
How old were you?
I must have been 8. Well, that would put it earlier, wouldn't it?
That would be 27.
Yes. So. And that was 2 or 3 years. I was old enough to... They had a governess, and she was useless, but perfectly agreeable. And I was supposed to learn things from her.
What did you think of Java, then?
It was lovely. I liked the people. It was full of interest. It was on a scale that, perhaps I was old enough to realize what countryside was like or could be like. And of course, it's a very beautiful island. And it has Yes, flat bits, but you're never very far away from pretty high hills. So again, one in the summer, one early, my mother and the two of us went up into the hills to a little house. My father used to come at the weekends and join us. And this is where one was taught to swim and this sort of thing. And I can't really remember my parents' friends, who were both Dutch and English. And I don't really remember playing with other children. I do in Shanghai, but I don't remember doing that in Java. But there must have been, I suppose. Or except possibly my sister was then old enough to play together. That was, I went back from that to a prep school.
Which one?
It was called St. Christopher's in Eastbourne. When I was still there, it went bust, and a new headmaster took over, and fortunately by that time, I was about 12 and was due to go to a boarding school, a public school, Loretto, near Edinburgh.
So you'd come back about 1930, and after a bit of the...
That's right, yeah. And of course, my father, being abroad nearly all his working life, meant that my mother was either with him or at home with us. And a great deal of the time when she was abroad with him, of course, my sister and I spent school holidays. We both had to be in boarding school by definition. We spent holidays with aunts, or and that worked out pretty well. I don't ever remember that we felt sort of bereft or isolated or abandoned.
Now, you were at Loretto School.
Yes.
Where's that?
That's just outside Edinburgh, about 10 miles from Edinburgh.
What's the town called?
Musselburgh.
Musselburgh.
Musselburgh, yes.
And what was the school like? Could you give us a sort of outline of what it was like?
Well, it was an interesting school. I mean, if you like, in those days, rather unfashionable, in as much as owing to its founding. It was founded in the days when boys were dressed as young gentlemen, and the man who founded it decided that this was a thoroughly unhealthy thing. So we never wore ties, for instance, all open neck all the time, except on Sundays when you went to chapel. No long trousers, everybody wore shorts, and you wore a kilt on Sundays. If you had to wear long breeks, for instance, if it was thought you better not wear shorts going back home in the end of term, you wore tweed suits or plus some kind of knickerbockers or plus fours. The school was very hot on them. You were not allowed to have bought cakes or sweets were absolutely not allowed at all. You were allowed to bring back from home cakes, homemade cakes, homemade jam. In fact, we took an immense amount of exercise. You had a cold tub every morning. Then you had a run across the Musselburgh Links, the old golf course, on which the Open Championship played a century and plus ago.
Oh, well, let's look at the school, because it's quite interesting, some of these older boarding schools. What was your accommodation like? I mean, your rooms, or presumably all in together.
Dormitories are different sizes. Usually quite small. I mean, I think the biggest one I was in was in one of the outhouses, one of the houses not in the main school block. And there must have been, I should think, 12 boys in that. But most of the rooms had about five or six boys in them. It was pretty Spartan because you again, part of this business of the healthy life, you know, never mind what the weather was like, the windows were sort of wide open at night. On the other hand, we were very well fed.
What was the food like?
Excellent. Plenty of it. I suppose it'd be looked on as fairly plain fare now, but I mean, you had a big bowl of porridge in the morning. You had Sunday mornings, you had sort of sausages and bacon and fried bread and so on. But most mornings it was a big bowl of porridge, to which you could add, if you wanted, sugar or salt or Lyle's golden syrup. This was things some people use. Lashings of milk, toast, butter, marmalade, and tea. And lunch was always meat. There are three people. I used to see them beside. It wasn't a very big school. In my day, there were only 140 boys there. There was a separate school for boys under 12. They were quite in a separate building and all the rest of it. But we had the school's drill section.
Hang on, you were talking about lunch.
Yeah. You want to see there's a PT instructor who was ex-Navy, and a drill sergeant who was ex-Army, and there's somebody else. I think it may have been the head groundsman. The three of them in big white aprons and carving knives standing behind three grit joints. And they carved away like fury, and the plates were brought to one. And you got a very generous helping of meat, as you could imagine, with the regime. Lots of healthy green vegetables. And then we ate for supper. You often had a boiled egg and, again, I suppose, toast and marmalade. And then at all times of the day, there was in just off one of the main corridors, there was a room which had a big barrel filled with, I think, must have been ship's biscuits. Large, plain biscuits, I think, almost half an inch thick. And these are awfully good. And always, bottles and bottles and bottles of milk. The only offence was to take the top, the cream, off sort of six bottles to fill your glass up. So any time you felt peckish, you would go and help yourself to a snack. We were extraordinarily well fed for that sort of day and age.
Now, how was your day organised?
Well, as I say, you got up, I suppose, at 7, clanging of a bell. You raced into one of the many bathrooms. The bathrooms had, this was pre-shower days, so there must have been in each bathroom sort of at least half a dozen big tubs. And you had to leave the cold water in those, and you jumped in and jumped out, so you didn't sit in it for an instant, and towelled yourself very briskly and got dressed. And then you trotted, or ran, if it was cold, as fast as you could, across the Musselburgh Links, the old golf course, and then back again. And then there was quite good breakfast waiting for you.
Now, what about the actual teaching of the day? I mean, how were you organised?
You were, of course, all in classes. This was partly by age, partly by ability. For instance, you could be the fourth form you began in the third form. For fourth form, you'd been at school a year and you'd moved up to that, and so on, up to the sixth. Within the form, for various subjects, you could be, for instance, fourth form 4A or 4B. And if you were, like me, bad at maths, you were in 4B and very lucky not to be dropped back to the third form, sort of thing. or if you were good at something, you were 4A, or you could occasionally be pushed up a form. That did mean that if you were a dullard at a particular subject, you didn't have any feeling of being a guy, or you weren't looked on as being you may have looked on as being a bit of a fool in that subject, but you weren't looked on as a total fool.
What about the teaching methods that they employed, and the sort of nature of the teaching generally?
The teaching was good. You went to different masters for different subjects. I mean, you went as a form to the French master, who was taking boys of a certain age, and then
you moved classroom. Then didn't come to you.
Around. No, you moved around at the double, which was again. The idea was to shake one's boots up after you've been sitting still. A good thing to move around. The only thing that they did sort you out a bit was that if you had no aptitude for, or they thought you had no aptitude for science, you didn't do biology or chemistry, you could take Greek instead. Greek wasn't Latin was compulsory for everybody at the beginning stage, and then you could, if you like, drop it and take up science, or skip science and do classics. And looking back on it, I think the teaching was pretty good.